work a little bit backwards. You would think higher resistance would give less current flow, yeah? Less voltage to the load, yes. Okay, that's not the example I was going to give. There was another example. Oh, yes. If you've got two resistors in parallel between the positive lead and the negative lead of the battery, and you now start changing the ratio of those resistors, because the explanation of resistance, let me drop. Because the explanation of what's going on with resistance, the electrons are trying to flow through and something is resisting them. So therefore, a resistor of higher value that's in parallel with a resistor of lower value, you would think because of the greater resistance, the greater, what's the word for it now? Reluctance to accept current is one way of putting it. Common sense would lead you to believe the greater resistor would be the hotter resistor. It's actually the other way around. The greater resistor has less current flow, same voltage. Therefore, the voltage times current tells you watts of dissipation. And you get a cooler resistor when the resistor is higher. So more resistance, in that example, gives you less heat. Okay. And another example is now I've got either an 18-gauge wire or a 14-gauge wire between my wall socket and an appliance. The common sense there would be that smaller resistance would have, we know that smaller resistance would have less heat flow. Greater resistance is going to have more heat flow. So in the case of wiring in series with, say, a refrigerator, more resistance creates more heat. In the previous example I gave of two resistors in parallel, more resistance gives less heat. The difference is that the parallel resistor example, the voltage across the resistors is fixed by the battery. In the case of the 14-gauge or 18-gauge wire feeding a refrigerator, the refrigerator is trying to accept a nearly constant voltage, and you'd like to have no voltage drop between the wall socket and the refrigerator. So the heating versus resistance works the other way around. You try to explain that to a set of students, and they're going to have trouble with it at first. WS2N, KQIZ, you go ahead, Paul.
Oh, I agree. You know, that would be, I guess that would be the next class, or maybe the next year. You start putting resistors in parallel, and you tell them that you can have actually more current coming out of that. They won't be able to handle that. You're actually, you know, unless you know, I mean, you could always use, I've used the analogy with water. You know, you could have one main going down the line, and you could have one valve, you know, slightly open. Going to have X amount of water coming out of that. And then if you have another valve in parallel going further down the line, and with that valve slightly open, you know, you're going to get a lot more water coming out of that. So, you know, it looks like the two resistors involved, it should slow it down even more. But that would be another concept. But I like, what was Roy's three words? I'm going to write it down in case my recording don't come out. Otherwise, I have to go back to where... what is it, amateurradio.tv, back to you there.
Roy is about to give us those words again. Come right ahead, Roy.
Okay, very good. I hope I don't drop out. I got accept, take, gather, and use.
Okay, we have accept, take, gather, and use. Very good. Thank you, Roy. Dick.
And to some degree, they all have a synonym definition with draw. And yes, the word draw. People who work with electronics tend to fall in certain vocabularies that become popular. When it comes to analyzing RLC circuits, there's a whole lot of rules of thumb you've got to learn. By way of examples, you find out that when you've got this kind of a topography, you use this way of analyzing it. Try to figure out how much voltage is at each one of the nodes is one way of looking at it, or how much current is flowing into and out of each of the nodes. Yeah. The really weird example is that you have an infinite grid. In other words, a whole bunch of horizontal lines and a whole bunch of vertical lines, and in the middle of each one of those lines is a 1-ohm resistor. And the grid goes to infinity, up, down, left, and right. And so somewhere in the middle of that grid is a single 1-ohm resistor that you've selected, which is connected to the rest of the grid. And somebody asks you the question, if I put my ohmmeter in that network across that particular one resistor, how many ohms will I measure? And you try to, by conventional means, calculate that. It's not easy. And the way the puzzle is given is that you're supposed to give an exact answer, not an approximate answer. And by way of substituting constant current generators when making the measurement, there's a way where you can give an exact answer to that crazy question. And maybe that's a puzzle we're going to bring up at some later time. I think we've gone down the list of everyone who checked in who had a question or a comment. I'm going to stand by to make sure I didn't forget anybody. K2LIW in the TechNet. Yeah, it looks like I didn't forget anybody. So now we're going to go over to the next section, which is Roy's Science Talk. And so go right ahead, Dr. Roy. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Dick. Thank you, Paul. This is AC2GS Roy, and let me just remind people, for what it's worth, everything that I talk about pretty much is going to have hyperlinks offered on a web page, and the web page to go to for that is roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. And if you have any comments, questions, answers, you want to tell me that I'm wrong or that I'm right or that you like puzzles or you don't like puzzles, whatever, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And we also have a chat room, and you can find that at chat.ac2gs.com. Let me drop, and we'll start tonight. Okay, it's very appropriate that we're going to go into a little bit of linguistics today, because we did a little with Paul earlier, and we'll do some now. Let's see. Last week, I asked if anyone knew the first meal eaten on the moon, and tonight I will ask what arguably was the first word spoken on the moon. I say arguably because it isn't like Armstrong and Aldrin were silent monks during the lunar landing exercise and waited until all the rockets were turned off, or at least set to the standby position before uttering a word. No, these words were said in the flurry of activity involved in landing of the first manned vehicle onto the surface of the moon. So, any guesses out there what the first word might have been? Now, I'm going to give you a hint. It's vaguely related to our own beloved hobby.
Contact light and one whitey white.
Yes, Hank.
Contact light is my guess.
Okay, any other guesses?
NW has to end, has to recuse himself with this question.
Holy shit.
Okay, I understand entirely, Paul. Any other suggestions? Again, this could lead to arguments, unfortunately, so I'm telling you up front that there's a whole bunch of things that were sort of said on the way down, and you could pick and whatever you have that word be when they landed. But we'll play this game as best we can. So any other people with any other thoughts of what the very first word spoken on the surface of the moon has been?
And who we are.
Yes, Richie.
Tranquility Base. You have landed.
No, afraid not. Any other guesses?
CDWH.
Yes.
Over.
That certainly is a good guess, because I'm sure there's a lot of that in the transcripts.
Touchdown.
Oh, that would be nice, too. Let me give you the transcript conversation as they are landing. They haven't landed yet. As they're landing, let's see, Buzz Aldrin says contact light. Neil Armstrong says shut down. Then Buzz Aldrin says okay, engine stop. And then Buzz Aldrin also says ACA out of detent. Then Neil Armstrong says, mode control both auto, descent engine command override off, engine armed of 413 is in. And then Armstrong says, engine arm is off, Houston, Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed. So basically everything was shut down, and they were talking about a bunch of things before they got to Tranquility Base, the Eagle has landed. Now, I don't know, for the sake of amusement, I kind of choose the line that he said right before he mentioned that the engine had stopped, because I guess that's what they mean by landed. So I personally like to think of okay as the first word said on the moon. Now, Paul, do you have a different opinion?
I don't know the call or the name of the fella that said contact light. I was going with that because that's the second that the vehicle hit the moon. They had these 5-foot probes sticking out of the bottom of the legs, out of the legs, and when they hit, so to me they were touching the moon. But if you're going to go by shutting the engine off after the engine off, that's different. But I was going to go with contact light. And what color was the contact light?
I don't know. What was it? I assume it was either red, amber, or green. So which color was it?
It was blue. I'm just adding that to it. It was blue.
Okay, very good. So, for the sake of arguments, we'll say that okay was the first word spoken because it helps me go for the rest of this little spiel. Does anyone out there have the faintest idea where the heck the term okay came from? Because I'm sure we all use it every day, and it's always kind of nice to know where we get these things. So, anyone have any idea where okay came from?
P2FIU.
Yes, George.
The most worldwide known symbol of affirmation, and it came from New York State, was a political term used, get old Kinderhook, a judge elected as president.
He wasn't a judge, he was already president. It was to get him re-elected president, George.
I can't remember right. Give me a second. I'm trying to remember which president.
Well, you're alluding to Van Buren, but it predates Van Buren. Anyone else? Any interesting guesses of where OK might have come from?
There have been previous attempts to explain it, where people thought it stood for all correct, and very poor spelling of all correct came out okay. I've heard that explanation, but I don't think it's very well documented. Over to you, Roy.
Part of their call sign, any other comments? Okay, I mean, again, you could argue etymology of words from today until next Wednesday. It's a good little hobby if you have nothing better to do. Well, there's numerous competing folk tales regarding the origin, okay, but the earliest recorded use for this term goes back to the Boston Morning Post on March 23rd, 1839. Apparently, among the smart-aleck upper crust in Boston, they felt it the height of wit to use the abbreviation of misspelled phrases to convey thought. So they would use KC for nuff said and KY for no use and OW for all right. And these things kind of came and went, but okay supposedly was for all correct, and that seemed to stick. The term appeared to achieve national prominence in 1840 when supporters of the Democratic Political Party claimed during the 1840 United States presidential election that it stood for Old Kinderhook, as George said, a nickname for the Democratic president and candidate for re-election, Martin Van Buren, a native of Kinderhook, New York. Vote for OK was snappier than using his Dutch name. Also, with the invention of telegraphy, OK became a common shorthand to acknowledge receipt of messages, and the interesting American Morse code, which was di-di-da-di-da, which doesn't really sound like OK to me, became fixed in the English language, or so they say.
82 FIU.
Yes, George.
Also, the most widely used form of expression of affirmation in all dialects in the world.
I agree 100% with you, George. It kind of apparently popped out someplace in Boston, and it took over the world. People may know very little English, but I think if you go to any part of the world and say the word okay, most people know what you're talking about. By the way, the most accurate name for what many of us use on the CW bands. It was actually invented by an employee of Morse's, a guy named Alfred Vail, and it isn't really a code. It's more accurately termed a cipher. So the more accurate name would have been Vail Cipher, but so much for history. Okay, as the links that I promised before, I found a source for many of the transcripts from NASA's manned missions. I posted a link on my webpage, roy.ac2gs.com, for the transcripts from the Mercury missions, the Gemini missions, and the Apollo missions. But if you don't want to hunt for some good stuff in those places, I also included a link to a rather funny article that shows a short portion of a transcript from the Apollo 10 mission that demonstrates that astronauts are people too. Now, talking about Apollo 10, we all know that it was a full dress rehearsal for Apollo 11's moon landing. Apollo 10's lunar module descended to an orbit of about 8.4 nautical miles from the lunar surface, at which point our descent could have commenced until Apollo 10 would have landed on the moon. Would anyone like to hazard a guess whether there was anything stopping these flyboy test pilots to make their own historic manned lunar landing other than simply their orders?
1YDY.
And WS2N.
As first Hank and then Paul.
I think NASA deliberately didn't give them enough fuel, if I remember correctly.
Paul?
I concur. I was going to say the same thing. they didn't want Eugene started saying, hey, I think I'm going to do this. But he got a shot later on in Apollo 17, so he wasn't too disappointed.
Yes, you're both quite correct. They didn't trust orders alone. They kind of went light on the fuel mix. They didn't have empty tanks, but they went light on it, and they were sure to tell everyone that, look, you land this thing, you ain't coming back. So it's interesting to think that they didn't take orders as the supreme way of controlling these guys. So that's another way of showing that our astronauts were human beings as well.
Comment, and 1YDY.
Yes, Hank.
Kind of did the same thing with Scott Crossfield and the big engine in the X-15 program.
Really? I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, he had gone to become a civilian employee of North American, and when they finally put the big engine in, he wanted to open it up and let it run, but his orders were not to. When he was dropped from the B-52, he had enough fuel that he could have opened it up. He didn't have enough fuel to make it back to where he was supposed to land if he had done so.
I guess the bottom line is trust no one, and I think that's probably wise in the long haul. Now, talking about the lunar module fuel, the lunar module ascent engine used something called a hypergolic propellant, which is a type of propellant that spontaneously ignites in the presence of its constituents. In the lunar module's ascent engine's case, a fuel called aerosene 5050 was used, which was a mixture of hydrazine and dimethylhydrazine, and an oxidizing agent called dinitrogen tetroxide. This kind of fuel is so corrosive that you can only use these engines once. You can test the engine design, but you can't test the same engine before you pack it up and send it off to lunar orbit where two astronauts' lives depend upon it to work the first time. So those were really brave guys because they flew in something that they weren't really sure would work.
There's another comment I've got with reference to the Apollo 10 possible landing, Roy, stand by. When you're going to land on the moon, the fact that you're at a low altitude and could land, that's a minor thing in your advantage. You've got to choose an extremely precise area on the moon to land, because if you choose an area of the moon that's near high noon, you're going to be exposed to ridiculously high temperatures. If you choose an area on the moon that's closer to sunrise or sunset, you're going to be exposed to ridiculously cold temperatures. So there's a very precise place where you've got to land to have the right temperature there during the time you're on the ground. Second of all, when you blast back off, you've got to have a very precise time of blasting back off in order to link up again with the command module that's in orbit. And if you don't link up with the command module, you're not coming home. So all kinds of exact calculations have to take place, exact landing location, exact takeoff times, and so on, in order to make all this work out. I'm not convinced that Apollo 10 had any of that information already in the memory of the system, if you know what I mean. So she just decided that, hey, I got the opportunity to land, and there's a nice smooth spot, let's go there. You do that, and you might not survive. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
Well, if all of these guys wanted a safe ride, they picked test pilot as a terrible career. There's a bit of recklessness, I guess, in the group of people, because they might have kind of had a mock solution to all the equations and locations and timing and such. But, you know, ultimately, as it says in black and white, they didn't trust these guys enough so that they actually limited the fuel. I mean, they didn't. There wouldn't be any particular benefit in not giving them enough ascent fuel to get out of there. So it was, I guess they still thought that it was a chance that these guys would take that risk.
G2GWH.
GWH.
Good evening. Just a quick comment. I was over at the Cradle Aviation, and just some time ago, where Module 7 is now housed. My question, and I don't know if it or so, but my understanding is that the last one that was complete while the program was terminated sat over in Grumman for 30 years. Does anyone know if the electronics and things that are in that module, they still work if the correct power sources were put into it?
Gosh, Paul, do you know any of that? I would assume that they shut it down and probably haven't turned it on for 20-plus years, because I still remember during the shuttle program that they sort of had to buy old equipment through eBay because there were no suppliers for these archaic devices that they had used. So I would assume that the last thing any of these guys would do would be turn on the lights.
They did have a mock-up, full-size mock-up in the yards out in Calverton, Roy. So I thought that was maybe the one that they put in Cradle, but then they said it wasn't. So that one might have the electronics in it. You know, they might have put a lot of stuff in there and just never used it. But they did have a full mock-up. I mean, you know, I was working out there, and you could walk around, touch it, climb up on top of it. On top of it, they just left it there. It was incredible. I don't know what ever happened to the mock-up.
There's another possibility here, Paul. Stay by. I think there was supposed to be an Apollo 18, one more moon landing, which got canceled. Quite possibly all the hardware, boosters and everything else, command service module and whatever, were built, and maybe the lunar module and the lunar rover car, the whole works. Isn't it possible that the Apollo 18 mission, all the hardware had been built? Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, they did definitely had an 18. In fact, they had a 19 and a 20, and they had long-range plans of 21, but they were getting cut little by little, and toward the end, they cut 18 altogether. But yeah, that's probably what it is. I agree.
Okay, so I guess everyone's talked out about Apollo 10. I'll give people a chance to make any closing statements, comments, and such before I move on to the next item.
A question in one way, what?
Yes, Hank.
Forgive my ignorance, but what happened to the descent stage? Did it crash into the lunar surface?
That's a good question that I didn't read anything about. Paul, do you know anything what happened to the descent stage?
All the descent stages are still sitting there on the moon, all six. The ascent stages brought them back up, and then they would dock with the command module. Then they would separate, and those modules would eventually crash back into the moon. So that's what happened to the ascent stage. But the descent ones landed there. And that's why I will bring up one more point before you leave the moon topic. Back to you, Roy.
But I was asking about the Apollo 10 descent stage.
Yeah, well, that would be, they would have separated with that and would have crashed into the moon. You know, wait a minute, there's a problem. I have to go back into this problem with that. One of them separated. I thought they put it into a solar orbit somewhere. I don't know if that was the ascent stage. There's a question about one of them I have. But yeah, I believe the descent stage must have crashed into the moon. The only one that made it back to Earth, of course, was Apollo 13. That burned up in the atmosphere.
I think the descent stages crashed on the moon. I know the lunar modules were placed in a solar orbit.
No, all the descent stages came down and then they would land. You know, you had the probes on the bottom. And that was going to be my question. How many probes were sticking out of the legs before they landed on the moon? That's going to be my question. They're 5 foot long before they hit the moon. And then the contact lights went on. It's a good piece of trivia. But all those landing stages, you come down with the landing stage, and then the engine shuts off, and then they climb out. They climb out, from the ascent stage onto what they used to call the porch, open the door, climb down the ladder, which was attached to one of the legs, and then they would go onto the moon, climb back up, get into the ascent stage. The ascent stage would take off with 8,000 pounds of thrust and bring them back to the command module. That descent stage stayed right there. That didn't go anywhere. Back to you.
Yeah, there was all kind of fun stuff on those lunar bases. We touched upon that a couple of months ago, that apparently Andy Warhol drew some graffiti art along with some artists, and it was kind of stuck into one of those legs. So there must be all kinds of fun stuff to be found on the moon these days.
Paul, did each one of the four legs have a contact probe? And when you landed, does the contact probe stick into the soil and break off? In which case, doesn't that represent a possible sharp hazard for an astronaut climbing down the ladder? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, so you would have gotten it right. There's four legs on the lander. So they had three probes. If you look at the original Apollo, I think it was the Apollo 10 descent module, the legs on that. You can see four probes, one on each leg. Then as time went by and before they sent up Apollo 11, they took one away because of that reason that you mentioned, Dick, that the one by the ladder, the ladder was attached to one of the legs, so that they took that out. They didn't want this possible aluminum 5 foot thing sticking up and puncturing up spaces as they came down the limb. But you can see, like, there's one picture of Aldrin standing by one of the legs, and you can see this aluminum tube jutting away from the limb. It's still attached, but it's going away from it. Sticking out of the ground, half in the dirt and half out of the regolith on the moon. Yeah, that's what happened to all of those. They were spring loaded, so as they came and separated from the last stage on the Saturn rocket, springs would pop open and these things would be sticking out 5 feet below the feet of the lander. Back to you, Dick, because you gave it to me.
Back to you, Roy.
Okie doke. let's move on to the next topic. More than a few of us here are fans of Star Trek franchise, so in that spirit, here's one for you guys. In the Star Trek universe, the star 40, Iridani A, alias HD26965, has long been canon as the son of Vulcan, the homeworld of the franchise's favorite pointy-eared science officer, Mr. Spock. This was first established in 1968 by James Blish's script anthology, Star Trek II, and later affirmed in the 1980s Star Trek Maps by Jeff Maynard. But it wasn't until 1991 that show creator Gene Roddenberry himself, backed by a few astrophysicists, penned a letter in scientific support of 40 Iridani as the probable host for Vulcan viability. Nearly three decades later, a new discovery from the University of Florida delivers some serious vindication to the choice, revealing a real-life planet actually clocking in at coordinates eerily reminiscent of the fictional M-class planet. Let me drop for a sec. A group of astronomers first visualized the Vulcan look-alike as part of the Dharma Planet survey, which is exploring some 150 very bright stars near our solar system. The discovery marks the project's first detection of a super-Earth, classified as a planet between 2 to 10 times as massive as our own. This new candidate boasts a radius twice the size of Earth and has nearly 9 times the mass. But the new find may have the potential to support life, and it's the closest known super-Earth orbiting another sun-like star. And what about that sun-like star? Compared to our own sun, 40 Iridani A is a little smaller and cooler, but though the two stars are separated by about 17 light years, they are thought to be about the same age, 4.6 billion years old. This long-time solar sustenance could reasonably give the Vulcan planet enough time to evolve complex life forms. What's more, this new celestial body orbits 40 Iridani A in what's called a habitable zone, or a region with temperatures that could theoretically permit the existence of liquid water, a key requirement to live long and prosper. Let me drop for a sec. HD26965 may be an ideal host star for an advanced civilization, says study author Tennessee State University astronomer Matthew Muttisbau in this release. That being said, the new super-Earth candidate isn't quite a home away from home. At their behemoth size and mass, many super-Earths exhibit a much higher gravitational pull than we're used to, making us feel several times heavier than we would here on Earth. To make matters worse, the newly detected planet's perimeter of orbit around 40 Iridani A is rather tight. A year there would barely last 42 days, and at such close proximity to its star, inhabitants could be exposed to some pretty toasty temperatures. There's a debate raging among astrophysicists as well about how livable super-Earths even are. Leading planetary scientists believe that many such super-Earths may be inhabitable. However, given the loose definition of these planets, issuing a single blanket statement about super-Earth habitability would be highly illogical, to borrow the words of one esteemed science officer. Let me drop for a second. Sadly, the newly detected planet is unlikely to acquire the official Vulcan moniker anytime soon. As we've mentioned on Science Talk before, Vulcan has already been tossed around as a hypothetical planet once thought to exist within the orbit of Mercury, and the International Astronomy Union's planet naming system can be rather prickly about names that tread on intellectual property rights. In fact, the IAU recently vetoed the name for one of Pluto's moons, but devoted Trekkers, many of whom are in space business themselves, may not be too bothered by that. After all, as planetary scientist Jesse Christensen of NASA pointed out on Twitter, the planet is not very much like fictional Vulcan, but, she continued, it's a planet orbiting the same star, and planets often have planet siblings. So I'm excited for more. Let me drop for a second. And until proven otherwise, the planet remains potentially habitable. So for those hoping for a first contact scenario, keep your eyes peeled to the sky. According to Star Trek lore, after all, humans and Vulcans were scheduled to meet in the not-so-distant future of April 5th, 2063. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okie dokie. Next on our list is a commonly used painkiller might be too risky for people to keep taking, suggests a new study published a few weeks ago in the British Medical Journal. It found that people who use diclofenac, a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, are more likely to come down with cardiovascular disease than people who take other non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs or acetaminophen. Diclofenac is sold under various brand names, including Aspirin, Cambia, Solaraze, both over-the-counter and via prescription. While the drug is perhaps not as well known as other non-steroidal anti-inflammatories in the United States, such as ibuprofen, it's actually one of the most popular and routinely recommended drugs sold across the world in both developing and developed nations. Diclofenac is categorized as an essential medicine in more than 70 countries, according to a 2013 study. Let me drop for a moment. For years, however, doctors have been worried about diclofenac's potential heart risk. Some research has suggested the drug would raise the risk of cardiovascular complications, similar to the now withdrawn non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, Rofecovac, otherwise known as Vioxx, which was pulled from the market in 2004. 5 years ago, it was widely approved. Because it would likely be unethical and costly to conduct the sort of large-scale randomized trial that would definitely confirm these suspicions, though, the Danish researchers behind the new paper opted for a unique study of sort. Using national population and prescription drug registries, they were able to look at the medical records of over 6 million Danish adults from 1996 to 2016. Then they used the data to emulate hundreds of clinical trials all at once. For example, they looked at people who reported taking diclofenac in 1996, then tracked their health for the next 12 months. While comparing them to people who either took another non-steroidal anti-inflammatory or acetaminophen or nothing at all. Let me drop for a moment. When all these simulated trials were averaged out, people who took diclofenac were 50% more likely to have cardiovascular problems in the first 30 days after use than were people who took nothing. There were also about twice as many likely to develop problems than people who took other non-steroidal anti-inflammatories or acetaminophen. The relative increased risk was seen across the board, including in people who took a lower dose as well as those at low risk of cardiovascular disease. Diclofenac use overall was also associated with a higher risk of gastrointestinal bleeding compared to other non-steroidal anti-inflammatories and acetaminophen. But its risk was similar to the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory naproxen, sold as Aleve. Let me drop for a sec. It's time to acknowledge the potential health risk of diclofenac and to reduce its use, the authors wrote. While the 50% figure is scary sounding, it's worth keeping in mind that absolute risk is still fairly small. Out of 1,000 people who take diclofenac and are at low risk for cardiovascular disease, the study estimated 4 extra people would develop a major health problem within a year, with one dying as a result, compared to people using no drug. For people at high risk of cardiovascular disease, that number would shoot up to 40, with half of them dying. The study also relies on observational data, so it can't prove directly that diclofenac is causing the problems. But given other research showing a similar heightened risk, the author says it's clear that diclofenac needs to be more carefully handled, if not phased out of use completely. Let me drop for a sec. Treatment of pain and inflammation with non-steroidal anti-inflammatories may be worthwhile for some patients to improve the quality of their life, despite potential side effects, they wrote. Considering its cardiovascular and gastrointestinal risk, however, there is just little justification to initiate diclofenac treatment before other traditional non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. They suggested diclofenac be banned as an over-the-counter drug and only prescribed with a warning label attached. Scientists should also avoid using diclofenac as a reference point to compare other non-steroidal anti-inflammatories and painkillers against it. In safety trials, given its unique risk, they said. If your doctor is prescribing this for you, I am not suggesting that you be your own doctor. I would suggest at your next visit, you might wish to address any concerns you might have with this particular drug of choice.
Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
M2EO.
Yes, Rich.
I guess the name of the truck. Made by Spicer. But, poor the stuff. Sponsored. I had a mild stroke. I was, for a year and a half, I was bedridden. Something else, I forget the name of it. I had, coming in to take, to walk me, the walker. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody. I forget the name.
I believe it was Vioxx in your case, and it's been taken completely off of the market. There's two other drugs that work the same exact way. The fancy term is it's a selective COX-2 inhibitor, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, and Vioxx was the one completely taken off the market. And I think that was the one that got you.
No, it was not Vioxx. It was something else. And the last I heard, it was on the market, but at a lower dose. I would never take it again. And when I go into a hospital, they automatically want to give me a blood thinner. I say, no thank you.
Maybe you were given Celebrex, but blood thinners are not the same as COX-2 inhibitor non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. So you mix in oranges with pastrami sandwiches.
But you're right, it was Celebrex.
Okay, very good. So the bottom line, caveat emptor, let the buyer beware, you know, if you're on these medications, you might want to have a chat with your physician, but I would not suggest that you be your own doctor, just as anyone is their own lawyer has a fool for a client, the same goes in terms of medicine. So just a little precautionary tale, if you're taking these things, ask your doctor what's up with that.
WS2N.
And then who are you?
Yes, first Paul and then Rich.
Yeah, it might be related because what I'm talking about is an inside also, I believe, is aspirin. You know, they give baby aspirin to people like the last, I don't know, 20 or 30 years. Now, recently, they said they did a test. I think it was 20,000 people or something, some large amount of people, half with and half without, and they found out that there really was no difference. So, you know, what's a patient to think back you were?
Well, you know, all these research studies are subject to modification. Some studies show one thing, others show a different thing. For a while, baby aspirins were practically a panacea. Not only did it decrease statistically the risk of heart disease, it also somehow decreased the risk of colon cancer, which no one could quite figure out why, but it was in the statistics. And yes, a recent study has suggested that for some elderly group, a preventive aspirin once a day has no beneficial effect, and all non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, unfortunately, have a risk of GI upset. So you have to factor that into the equation. So I don't think that medical science has given up on aspirin quite yet. People will be reading these studies and try to make better sense of them as time goes on.
Okay, so not related to the diclosamine, I think you said diclosaminatic, I don't know, I forget what you said, but not related to that topic.
Yeah, this is a little different. It's called diclofenac, and you get bonus points if you can pronounce some of the names these guys come up with. In the case of diclofenac and the entire class of COX-2 selective inhibitor, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, and say that three times fast, they do increase people's risk of cardiovascular disease. Now, the study that showed that aspirin didn't help just showed it didn't help. It didn't harm you, in terms of cardiovascular disease. So older non-steroidal anti-inflammatories don't seem to have that same gotcha that the selective non-steroidal anti-inflammatories have. Say again.
Whiskey 2 Bottle Zoo, did you turn it over to me? I have a question.
Okay, I didn't get your entire call sign, but sure. What do you have to say?
It's Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu Rich. You know me, W2BZ. You know, the media, you know, attention is all on the opioid crisis in this country. But if you forget that whole group of people who are doing it for fun, there are people like myself, and I'm sure others, you know, on the net, that do live in pain. So what's the answer to pain? If so far everything seems to make everything worse, what is the answer to true pain?
And no one's come to any conclusion. As far as the use and abuse of opiates, it's like anything that's human-based. There are trends. There are pendulums that swing in one direction and the other direction. If you would have taken a snapshot around 1970 to 1980, there was a lot of doctors who didn't want to give terminal patients who were dying soon opiates because they didn't want them to become addicted by the time they died. I don't really understand, but they were very, very tight with the opiates. And around 1980, the gates opened and everyone and their brother got given opiates. You got a toothache, here's an opiate. You got an earache, here's an opiate. You stubbed your toe, here's an opiate. So we went too much in the other direction, and a lot of companies designed all kinds of delightful, and I'm being sarcastic, opiates that were incredibly strong and incredibly addicting and incredibly abused. And so now we have a mess of all the people who had a good reason, sort of, to be put on it originally, but continued on it far too long and now are addicted to it. So it's a big, incredible problem that doesn't have a solution quite yet. I wish there was a simple way of turning off our pain receptors. It would make life very easy.
I think the answer might be in electronics.
It might be, but we need to understand how the human body works more to really do it with finesse. We can sort of jam some of the circuits in a haphazard way, but there's probably a much more sophisticated method that we don't have a clue about yet. Okay, Doc. Any other questions or comments on this subject before I move on to the next?
Can you skip the answer wheel?
Yes, Rich.
Okay, I wonder if Celebrex is still on the market. The other thing is, I heard that they want to take all opiates off the market. That worries me. No, I have Tourette syndrome. That's one of the few drugs that helps me. My prescription, Raylite, is up to 0.5 milligrams 3 times a day as needed. Some days I need it, some days I don't. So I don't think I'm addicted. I just don't want to be the poor guy of medicine controlled by the government.
Well, I'm sorry, Rich, but medicine is controlled by the government. That's the way governments tend to work. Celebrex is still being sold. The prescription receipt has a black bordered box cautioning people about its risk of cardiovascular disease, and it's not selling quite as well in the United States as it used to, but as I mentioned, it sells reasonably well elsewhere, and I don't think all opiates are going to be made illegal, because then a lot of people are going to go through with withdrawal, and some of them are going to die, and that really looks bad in the press. So they might pull certain rather new synthetic opiates that have no legitimate reason for kind of existing. They might do that, and they'll restrict the use some degree. New York State has been very increasingly restrictive over the years. It went from a triplicate form to an electronic form to a limited 7-day prescription. So it's only going to get worse that way, but I don't think they're going to shut it off entirely because of the side effects that that might...
NYDY.
Yes, Hank.
Different opioids have different pathways for blocking pain.
They all sort of work on the same channels. Some of them are somewhat antagonistic, others less antagonistic. Some trigger euphoria more than others, but the pain relief channels tend to be about the same.
When you hear something like fentanyl versus oxycodone, are these methods or that they have brain cells with, or do they work basically, as you say, along the same way, same route, same pathways?
They pretty much work the same pathways. The difference is fentanyl has a much nicer fit to the slot that triggers these things, and so the dosage of fentanyl to get the same pain relief effect is much smaller, which means that when people abuse it, they abuse it a lot more than they could possibly swallow of the other medications, and that's one of the reasons fentanyl is killing people. I mean, every year you hear about movie stars and musicians who just suddenly die, and usually you find out after the fact that they pump themselves with fentanyl to sleep or whatever their excuse might be. So it's the same channels, but some molecules fit better than others, and fentanyl really is for design, it's beautiful in that it really turns that lock.
Okay, thank you. M1YDY clear.
M3EO again.
Yes, Rich.
Okay. Those drugs are really the only type of drugs that really help me with my neurological threats. That helps tremendously. I'd hate to see it all off the market. Really feel that the government has no right to play doctor. The MDs know what they're doing and it's not restricted. But I'm worried about that in the future. I understand the law now is that I have to renew it once a month, not renewable. So with 30 days in a month, I get 30 pills. And, 90 pills. Writes it, my doctor writes it up to 3 pills.
TBC?
Yes, BZ recognized. Well, let me just touch upon what Rich said. If you document that it's a chronic disorder, you can write a 30-day supply. If you can't or don't write that it's a chronic disorder, New York State will only allow you a 7-day supply. And whereas you and maybe I think that it would be really nice if doctors have a say in how medicine works, that isn't the way reality works. Government has a big say, and insurance companies probably have even a bigger say. And occasionally they might even listen to us poor doctors.
Well, I've also heard, I don't know where I heard it, you may confirm it. I heard that a lot of doctors don't want to prescribe it at all because they feel that they're going to be put in jeopardy by writing too many prescriptions in the, I don't know if it's the FDA or what will come down on it. That's basically what happened. I've had doctors that will not prescribe it because they are afraid. Also, something else I wanted to bring up. But that's basically it. I do get my 90 pills a month, but I hope they don't discontinue. Oh, the other thing. I've heard some pharmaceutical chains not even prescribe them for anybody. They don't want the extra paperwork. Got it, boy.
Well, it's like any other business. I mean, you talk with your money and you go to someplace else. Some pharmacies sort of amaze me. There are pharmacies that only open up at 10, 11 o'clock, and then they close at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And if you need stuff on the weekends, sorry, they're closed, and they're almost doing it as a hobby. So it's very possible that they don't want the extra paperwork, and so they decide to go without, and people who use them can choose to use other people. Being a concern that you might be thought of as a drug pusher, people might, doctors might feel that way. I think it's a little bit paranoia. Unfortunately, if you look at statistics, there's usually something like the top 100 doctors who prescribe these things in the country are prescribing half of all those drugs in the country. So there are obviously painkiller mills. There are offices that just you go in, you mutter something about pain, and you get in the prescription for an opiate. Those are the guys that the DEA are going to knock about. So I don't know. But it's possible that the doctors can feel a little paranoid and be a little worried and concerned and not want to wake anyone up to have them take a sniff around them. So, you know, it's difficult times, and it's like any other pendulum. It's probably going to swing farther into restrictions before the pendulum starts to swing in the other direction.
Oh, I know what you mean. The only thing is I don't want to get hurt. What I mean by hurt is one of the few drugs that helps me. I can take either Ativan or, what's the other one? Ativan or Xanax. The one works equally as well.
Okay, them are opiates.
Opiates, you drop them.
Say again.
Emily, popping out.
I'm not quite understanding what you're saying. Both of those medications you described are diazepams. They're tranquilizers. They're not opiates. They're not related to opiates. They're not controlled like opiates. Now, you may, in fact, have opiates in addition to that. And once again, I would tend to doubt that they're going to cut you off because you're not the only guy who's to taking them, and there would be a you and outcry. So I wouldn't worry too much.
W2BZ. Okay, BZ, you have a terrible hump on your system. But okay, go on to the next people. I don't want to tie this up. Roy, thank you. And to you.
You're welcome. Rich BZ, you had a comment?
Just a quick question, because I don't want the subject people to this hump. Fentanyl, they say it's 100 times more potent than heroin. They say it, the media says that, in other words, it's 100 times more dangerous. What's the reason for that?
Well, like I said before, most of these things work by fitting into a slot in a molecular array of structures on cell walls, and opiates all have about the same active area where they fit into that lock, but some fit into it better. You know, some keys are closer to the optimum key than others, and things like codeine and dextromethorphan have really rotten keys, and they barely turn the lock. But things like fentanyl are kind of built perfectly for that key, for that lock, and it just slides very easily. And so you need far less molecules of fentanyl to get the same cellular reaction, which, among other things, is respiratory depression. And respiratory is depressed and you stop breathing, that tends to lead to death.
If that's the case, then why wouldn't, you know, Alex get the same high with much less of it with which I think wouldn't that equalize out the danger with something like heroin?
Well, the problem is people tend to maximize whatever they're taking. But as I mentioned before, there's two effects of the pain relief, of opiates. One is pain relief, which is one lock and key. The other is euphoria. So in order to get the same euphoria, say, of heroin, you probably have to go heavier with the fentanyl.